Welcome to the London School of Economics, everybody. So I'm Wouter Den Haan. I'm a professor here at LSE. It's my job to introduce our guest speaker, but first some announcements. So our guest will first give a talk and introduce her new book, The Production of Money, How to Break the Power of the Banks. And after that, there will be an opportunity for you for some Q&A. We expect the event to be over somewhere between 7:45 and 8 o'clock. It's because of the stewards wanting to go home, we always definitely have to be out here by 8. Now, please turn on your mobile on silent or turn it off. Now, I always ask that, but it still now and then happens that somebody completely embarrasses him or herself. So the event is being recorded. In fact, it's broadcast live, I think. And if everything goes well, we will also make a podcast available on the website of LSE Events. There is a hashtag for those of you guys who want to tweet, and it's I think it's LSE Money. I think it should be on here somewhere too. But oh yeah. And then after the event, there is the possibility to buy the book and to get it signed. And the way it's going to work is you can buy it outside, and then you can come back on the podium to get it signed. So now let me turn to the more important part of my job, which is to introduce our guest. So Anne Pettiford is currently director of PRIME, which stands for Policy Research in Macroeconomics, which is a multidisciplinary network to engage with a diverse audience in order to, and I quote literally from the website, to demystify economic theories, policies, and ideas. She's also an honorary research fellow at the City University here in London and part of the UK Labour Party's Economic Advisory Committee. But what's really amazing is that all the things she has done in the past. I mean, I've just been an academic my whole life, and so there isn't that much on my webpage except, you know, publications. But she has done a wide variety of things, and there's just too much to mention. But and so not only has he worked on many different topics, but also worked with many different types of organizations. But let me mention a few. So she has been co-founder of Jubilee 2000, a worldwide campaign for the cancellation of the debts of the poorest countries, so clearly important. She has advised governments, politicians, and international organizations. And so I want to ask you to join me in welcoming our speaker.
Thank you very much, Professor Den Haan, and particularly thank you because I think it's been extremely generous of the Department of Economics and the Centre for Macroeconomics to have me here tonight, because they know that I'm going to be harsh about the economics profession, and that and for me means that they're generous and open-minded, and that is enormously encouraging. I'm also a trustee of something called the Foundation for the Promotion of Pluralism in Economics, and I believe that's really where we should all be going. I thought I might just begin by saying a little bit about myself and my journey before I've got to, and how I've got to where I am. I was born in South Africa, and as a child, my father, who'd been a hero in the war and flown liberators and Wellingtons for the RAF, decided and then came back from the war and couldn't get a job. There was very high levels of unemployment in South Africa. And he had this crazy idea of moving to a little town in the outback called Oudendalsrus, as far away from civilization as you could get in South Africa, to start a little business, a dry cleaning business. And the reason he went there was because Anglo-American had discovered gold in the area in 1947. And he thought he could get rich quick there. Anyway, what happened was that Anglo-American approached the burghers of Oudendalsrus, this little town, to ask if they could camp in the town. You know, they would invest, they'd provide investment, they'd create jobs, you know, and give opportunities. And of course, these burghers were all Afrikaners, had fresh memories of the Boer War, and said nothing called Anglo-American is coming to our town. And so my parents decided that I'd have to go to school in the town that Anglo-American relocated to, a place called Velcom, which was a long way away. And every day my dad would drive me into school in his old van. And we would talk about economics and politics. And we'd talk about the fact that gold underpinned the economy of Oudendalsrus and of the area, of the Orange Free State, and indeed of the whole of South Africa. And yet the price of gold had been fixed in 1933, and here we were in the late 50s, 60s, and the price had not changed at all. My poor old dad had to explain to me about the international financial architecture, the international financial system, Bretton Woods. So as a sort of 8 or 9 year old, I already had a sense of this great overarching structure which influenced the little town that I was growing up in. And of course, it was a town based on gold, so I learnt about gold. And in particular, I learned that gold is finite, because Wooden Wrist today is a ghost town, essentially, because, of course, the gold is no longer economically viable for extraction. So these were important lessons, but I also learned about laundering from my dad, and that, I think, qualifies me to become a commodity trader in the City of London, and I don't know why I never did. So that's where I've come from. And then, of course, I got involved in the sovereign debt campaign, Jubilee 2000. And that taught me, again, a great deal about the global economy and the financial system. I spent 3 years at the New Economics Foundation trying to understand why it was that countries that had never had any debts before 1971 suddenly became very heavily indebted after 1971. Why it was, if you know the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time is Different, there is a famous chart in it, and it shows financial crises from 1800s onwards, and it shows the volatility and the recurring nature of financial crises until the 20s and 30s, then the Second World War. And then there's a period where the chart goes flat, and there are virtually no crises at all between 1945 and 1971. The Bretton Woods era. That is the era that's known in economics as the golden age of economics. And after 71, we see once again the volatility and the recurrence of financial crises until we, of course, implode in 2007-09 with the global financial. All of this fascinated me, and I wanted to understand when I was at the New Economics Foundation why it was that countries had got indebted. And at the time, everybody said it was down to the oil crisis in OPEC, but that didn't make sense to me. And that's when I started to read Eric Herlina, and we produced a book, The Real World Economic Outlook at the NEF, and we predicted the financial crisis way back in 2003. But we were laughed out of court. So there you go. But we're now quite well known for the fact that we did actually see the crisis coming. So to come back to where we are today, is 10 years after the catastrophic failure of both the global banking system and the global economy. Economic disorder is once again leading to political and social disorder. Western democracy and its political parties, central banks, its judicial system, and civil society have collectively failed to protect society from the predatory behavior of global financial markets, mostly rent seekers, and from the ideology and impacts of market fundamentalism. In the absence of organized labor unions, and with political parties both hollowed out, compromised, and even corrupted by financialization, those who largely live by hand and brain and not from rent have taken measures to protect themselves. And those measures are not always pretty. High levels of unemployment or underemployment, falling incomes, housing crises, and obscene levels of inequality have led, predictably, to the rise of counter-movements in all the leading economies, as foreseen by Karl Polanyi in the 1940s. These counter-movements threaten to further undermine an already enfeebled Western democracy. At the same time, the inability of democracy and our financial system to respond to the threat of climate change imperils the very future of the ecosystem and therefore of humanity. Our world is dangerously disordered. The word apocalypse is on the lips of many. But as the writer China Mirvel argues, apocalypse and utopia are intertwined. At the end of one order, there is always a horizon of hope. It is my humble view, and there can be no more humble view, that the current economic disorder is largely because of the invisibility of the global financial system and of the workings of the great public good that is our monetary system. What cannot be seen, what is not transparent, cannot be held to account and cannot be monitored and cannot be changed. So I think it is absolutely vital that the public as a whole should have a better understanding of the monetary system. So I'm on a mission to use what I have learned from other venerable economists to explain money, especially to women, to environmentalists, and to the wider public in what I hope is accessible language. And my hope and my confidence is based on real-life experience. When we started Jubilee 2000, we were mocked out of court, really. Nobody believed that you could run a campaign in the 1990s at the height of Thatcherism and of loads of money. Do you remember that time? Nobody believed you could run a campaign at that time about the cancellation of the debts of the poorest countries and get the British public interested. And yet we did. We did it largely through education. We did it largely through sharing information and knowledge with people. And we had no money. We had no resources. We had no great institutional power. And what we found was that when people understood, when they understood and they grasped the reality of the relationships between North and South, creditor and debtor, they became angry and they mobilized themselves. And so to our astonishment and to the astonishment of the Prime Minister, Tony Blair and others, 100,000 people turned up to the G8 summit in Birmingham in 1998 because they felt angry about the debts of the poorest countries and the fact that the richest countries would refuse to deal with them. And from that experience, I learned that actually education, understanding is mobilizing and is empowering. So before I go further, I want to say this. Nothing that I share with you tonight is original. Economists have understood the nature of money since the days of the Florentine and Dutch bankers, but in particular since 1705, when that great Scottish genius, John Law, published his book, Money and Trade, and then went on to heroically and almost single-handedly to try and construct a sound monetary system and financial architecture for both France and Britain. Professor Antoine Murphy of the University of Dublin has, with the biography of Law, done a great deal to revive the reputation, the well-deserved reputation, of a man about whom Schumpeter, in his History of Economic Analysis, called Law's brilliance and, yes, profundity, which places him in the front ranks of monetary theorists of all time. I don't know how many students here have learnt and read John Law, but I certainly hope that he gets put on the curriculum at some point. John Law was followed by Henry Thornton, born in 1760, Henry Dunnan MacLeod, born in 1821, John Maynard Keynes, another who is in the front ranks of monetary theorists of all time, and whose monetary theory and policies are disgracefully neglected, born in 1883. Then there was Joseph Schumpeter, born in 1883 as well, J.K. Galbraith, born in 1908, Hyman Minsky, 1919, Wynne Godley, 1926, Victoria Trick, 1936, who is still with us, and Jeff Tilley and many other economists have understood the monetary system. I am confident that drawing on their knowledge and wisdom will help us find the horizon of hope that with greater public understanding, transparency, transformation of the global economy is possible. Anyway, that is the ambition of my modest little book. Today, strong men and women that ride the populist wave promise us nationalism and protectionism. Their promises are based on the tired old Ricardian economic model of liberal, self-regulating markets in money, trade, and labour. In other words, markets that were once embedded in social relations, but that are now virtually detached from all forms of regulatory democracy. The sunny uplands that they promise us are a delusion. Mrs. May pretends to offer to take back control from those citizens of nowhere that govern the global economy by prioritizing the domestic economy. But at the same time, she stresses that Britain will remain a global Britain. The reality of life under a model that elevates the global over the domestic economy was starkly exposed recently by the fate of a small tea room based in Highcliffe, Dorset, Highcliffe Castle, Dorset. The tea room had been owned and run by a local, Sean Kearney, for 17 years. It was put out to tender by the council. The company that won the tender was a global behemoth, the $14 billion Aramac Corporation that owns prisons and canteens around the world and is headquartered in Philadelphia. This storm in a tea room, as the Times dubbed it, was a classic example of how today's economic model fails the people of Britain. It pits the minnow of a locally owned tea room against a globally powerful and financially mobile shark. As a result, Sean Kearney may well now become one of those left behind by British government policies. Depressingly, our politicians on both sides of the House learn nothing from this. Despite all the nationalist rhetoric, we know that the dominant economic model that led to the populist uprising for Brexit has not been seriously challenged by any of our politicians. The government will continue to stand aside as footloose mobile capital uses its absolute advantage to swallow up the enterprising minnows of the economy. And the opposition parties continue to remain silent on these issues. Now, it should come as no surprise that societies are angry and in revolt. After all, the world has suffered ongoing economic failure since the financial crisis of 2007-9. Despite the determined effort of central banks to pump something like $500 billion every quarter into the private financial system as a form of life support for banks and shadow banks, despite this massive dispersal of taxpayer-backed liquidity, commercial banks are still essentially insolvent, global commercial banks, and reluctant to lend. The failure to restructure global banks and reform the banking system means that the crisis has rolled around from its epicenter, the Anglo-American economies, into Europe, especially Southern Europe, and has now moved and is hurting emerging markets. They face rapid outflows of capital, exchange rate volatility, high levels of corporate debt, rising borrowing costs, a strong US dollar, and now protectionism. Brexit, Donald Trump, Rodrigo Duterte, General Sisi in Egypt, and Julius Malema in South Africa are all manifestations of public revulsion at our freewheeling, corrupt, and often fraudulent global financial system, a system that leaves many of millions unemployed, impoverished, and in despair, while at the same time the system fantastically and almost effortlessly enriches the 1% of the global rentier economy. All the while, the mainstream economics profession remains detached, aloof, even from the events and developments. As a profession, economists take no responsibility for the crisis. They shrugged off the Queen's question about why the crisis was not foreseen. In this respect, economists are very different from real scientists, like the physicists and aeronautical engineers that take responsibility for keeping millions of airline passengers safe in the air and who take every precaution to prevent crashes. Economists just shrug their shoulders as if these ongoing crises have nothing to do with them, but are the responsibility of politicians, policymakers, subprime borrowers, or Britain's low productivity workforce. Worse, they offer us no alternative to the current dominant economic model that has led to political upheaval, financial liberalisation, monetary policy dominance, and fiscal austerity. All we're offered in the way of hope is something called secular stagnation. Now, this may come as a surprise to the average woman in the street, but until the great financial crisis, economists and economic textbooks made light of money, banks, and debt. Indeed, they still do. Money was treated as a mere veil over the real activity of the economy, the trade in goods and services. Even while economic students have begun to revolt and object to the absence of money, banks, and debt in their curricula, today's economists, through no fault of their own, are not equipped to study or teach monetary theory, policy, and practice. They were never taught it themselves. Since the financial crisis, some have tried to insert money into their dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, But that has not changed their worldview, their dominant economic model. As a collective, and of course, with very honourable exceptions, economists continue to fail to grasp the seismic nature of changes wrought by the private finance sector to the global economy since the 1960s. It was Adam Smith that first asserted that money is a, quote, neutral medium that facilitated exchange on the great wheel of circulation. And it was Paul Samuelson, he of the endless editions of Economics 101, editions which have sold all over the world and been taught to millions of students, who argued that even in the most advanced industrial economies, if we strip exchange down to its barest essentials and peel off the obscuring layer of money, we find that trade between individuals or nations largely boils down to barter. It is ideology, not science, that asserts that the market in money is like the market in widgets and must be left to the forces of supply and demand and not regulated by governments. It is ideology that asserts that bankers are simply intermediaries between savers and borrowers and do not create credit out of thin air. That the central bank is responsible for the nation's money supply, when in fact it's private commercial banks that are responsible in Britain, ask Mervyn King, who's just been here, for 95% of the money supply. It is ideology that asserts that money, like trade and labour, must not be managed, but must be mobile and free to dodge taxation and to go wherever capital gains can effortlessly be made, most often by rent gouging. It is ideology that permits governments and central banks to stand idly by as mobile and unaccountable capital markets periodically wreak havoc on exchange rate markets, bond markets, and commodity markets. Central banks are reluctant to extend the use of macroprudential tools to erect bumps in the road to manage or even block flows, not because they can't do so, even in this digital age, but because economists at the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, and the world's treasuries have actively promoted unfettered, unregulated capital mobility, even as they now begin to backtrack on that advice. Until quite recently, to argue against capital mobility was like arguing for a return to the Soviet gulag. It is ideological to argue that the reasoning that informs the microeconomy can be extrapolated to reach conclusions about the macroeconomy. In other words, the fallacy that the budgets of households, the microeconomy, can be aggregated and compared to the budgets of governments, the macroeconomy. Arguments used for slashing government expenditure. It is ideological to argue that public debt crowds out private debt, when in a slump, public debt helps revive a weakened private sector. And it is ideology that asserts that the public sector is rent-seeking, while a blind eye is turned to the rapacious rent-seeking of the private sector. Unsurprisingly, these flawed ideological theories and models are a great comfort to the financial elites, as that wonderful city trader Satyajit Das argued in his book, Traders, Guns and Money. He wrote, "Modern finance is generally incomprehensible to ordinary men and women. The level of comprehension of many bankers and regulators is not significantly higher. It was probably designed that way, like the wolf in the fairy tale, all the better to fleece you with." Das expresses well why so many in the finance sector are content for the economics profession to have a blind spot for modern finance. All the better to fleece you with. Both our recurring financial crises and the inability of the economic professions to protect us from failure boils down, in my view, to a deeply flawed understanding of the very foundation of the global financial system, money. So, what exactly is money? It's a real challenge to be able to do this in this lecture, but I hope you'll bear with me. The first thing to understand about money is that it's not just the coins and notes in your purse, nor is it even just bank money and digital transfers that you make each day with your debit and credit card, or that flies around the globe in billions of a second. No, money, above all else, is a system. A socially constructed and man-made system. Money is only in plentiful supply when it is backed up by public authority. Sound, publicly funded or publicly backed institutions. Institutions that uphold trust. That is why Bitcoin, that is mined in the dark web on the basis of distrust, so their founders tell us, is not money. But I am not going to get into a discussion of Bitcoin at this point. The institutions that are central to the money system include A, the central bank, the only institution authorized to issue a nation's currency and to print and mint notes and coins. The central bank helps maintain the value of a nation's currency or unit of account by demanding that taxes are paid in that currency, and it also sets the bank rate, which applies only to the banking sector and helps to influence the value of the currency. No one, by the way, that I know pays 0.25% for a loan. Only the banks and the finance sector does. The second is the taxation and tax collection system itself, which serves as a means of valuing the nation's currency. The more taxpayers, the better the tax collection system, the harder the currency. The third is the private banking system, which creates or prints, to use the language of monetarists, 95% of the money supply. Of course, banks don't print money, only the central bank does. But they create 95% of the money supply by creating credit and depositing money in bank accounts. And then there's the judicial and criminal justice systems for the enforcement of contracts. No bank can manage without having a judicial system that will enforce its contracts. And that is the reason why all the global banks are headquartered here in London, because our publicly financed and backed judicial and criminal justice system helps them to uphold their contracts. Finally, there's the accounting system, and especially double entry bookkeeping. And it was the genius of the discovery of double entry bookkeeping which enabled Florentine bankers to flourish. And that is for keeping accounts of assets and liabilities. If these institutions are missing, if building these institutions is discouraged, as it is in many of the poorest countries of the world that I've worked in, by the ideology that has long permeated the IMF and World Bank, i.e. that these public institutions are not necessary, the private sector can do it all, or if these institutions are corrupted, then the consequence is straightforward. There simply is no money. Go to poor countries where there is no money. These institutions are not present. This system does not work. So then we move on to money itself and the price of money, the rate of interest. These two are social constructs, social relationships and social arrangements based primarily and ultimately on trust. Money, as Joseph Schumpeter argued, is nothing more than a promise to repay. And promises can be made or affirmed or created out of thin air. The thing we call money has its original basis in belief. Credit, or the Latin verb credo, means I believe. I believe, I trust you will pay or repay me now or at some point in the future. Credit is money, a claim to fulfill a promise. The counterparty to that credit has an obligation to make good on that promise. Obligations and claims become credits and debts. Back in the day, and in due course, tokens were issued to represent those credits, those promises. They became tangible representative manifestations of the claims and obligations, which quickly became numerous. They facilitated transactions, the exchange of promises, the thousands and millions of transactions that supported economic activity. They became the means whereby goods and services were valued and exchanged, not for which goods were services and services were valued in exchange. Of course, some promises were more risky than others, some debtors less trustworthy than others. So a price was attached to the promise, a price that varied depending on the riskiness of the promise. Trustworthy promises had a low price. Less trustworthy promises had a higher price. Harvard graduates in the U.S. pay lower rates of interest than pole dancers in Florida or hairdressers on $7 an hour in Michigan. The price of those promises and therefore of credit or money was and is decided on a one-to-one basis, just as it is today. The price or the interest rate of a loan, it was never the outcome of the supply and demand for money. Instead, it was and is always determined on the basis of risk by clerks in banks or other financial institutions. Bankers call the process of pricing a loan or credit risk assessment. We now know, for example, that the most important interest rate in the world, the London Interbank Offer Rate, or LIBOR, critical to determining rates of interest on $800 trillion of student loan contracts, on home mortgages, on business loans, and on the loans given to bail out the private banking system, was never a natural rate of interest, the product of the supply and demand for money. No. It was the result of very human activity, the fixing or manipulation by young, mostly male, risk-taking traders or submitters based in the back offices of banks. So, Josephine Bloggs is prudent, hardworking, and has great skills. She has a degree from Oxford and is on a career path. She's bound to repay. There's little risk of her promise not being honoured. Joe Bloggs, on the other hand, is young, tends to drink too much, works part-time, and like millions of traders in financial markets, is a risk-taker. As an unreliable maker and keeper of promises, he will be charged a much higher rate for his promise or the use of money if he's lent money at all. So, money is not a commodity, nor is money about barter. Now, David Graeber challenged the orthodox view of money as barter when he argued in his book, his great book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, that man-made credit and credit systems have existed since forever. Credit and debt, not barter, has been a feature of community life since the dawn of time. Credit systems existed in communities where there was familiarity and trust, and where trusted figures, the priest, the chief, the trusted elder, upheld trust. Only when the village had to bargain and exchange with strangers, where trust had not been established, was barter resorted to. In villages or small communities where promises were made, where transactions became obligations to fulfill and claims to honour, the obligations and claims were invariably monitored, overseen and enforced by someone with authority, someone that ensured both obligations and claims were honoured. In other words, a trusted authority managed the system. It wasn't left to the individuals to manage it themselves. Money, in this view, as John Law first explained in 1705, is the measure by which goods are valued, the value by which goods are exchanged, and in which contracts are made payable. It is not, as in barter, the thing for which we exchange goods and services. To understand this, think of your credit card. There is no money in most credit card accounts before a user begins to spend. All that exists is a social contract with a banker, a promise or obligation made to the bank to repay the debt incurred as a result of spending on the card, and to repay at a certain time in the future and at an agreed rate of interest. And when money is spent on your credit card, you do not exchange the card for the products you purchase. This is because money is not like barter. It's the measure by which goods are valued and exchanged. No, the card goes back into your purse. It is the credit card and the trust on which it is based that gives you the power to purchase a product or service. The bank, if you're trustworthy, the bank will issue a platinum card. If you're not deemed trustworthy, you'll probably not get a credit card. The credit card, once authorized, is the means by which you acquire purchasing power. And that is the great magic and wonder of the monetary system. The spending on a card is expenditure created out of thin air. The intangible credit is nothing more than the bank's and the retailer's belief that the owner of the card and her bank will honor an agreement to repay, a belief that in the case of credit cards is not even backed by collateral. As such, all credit and money is a social relationship of trust between those undertaking a transaction, between a banker and its customers, buyers and sellers, debtors and creditors. So while all money is credit, and all credit is money, it is also the case that all money is debt, just as all obligations are simultaneously claims. Now, many of my friends in the monetary reform movement, especially those in the sovereign money movement, believe that debt and the power of private banking system to create credit is a very bad thing. And indeed, so it can be. If credit and debts are allowed to expand beyond the capacity of debtors to repay, or even of the economy as a whole to repay, they become a millstone naturally around the necks of borrowers and countries. But while banks have power over borrowers and use inducements to flog loans, it is important to remember that it takes two to tango in this relationship. Credit or debt cannot be created until a borrower applies for a loan. There was and always a counterparty when a bank or a shadow bank creates money, credit, or debt. Private commercial banks cannot create credit, money, out of thin air unless there are borrowers. Private commercial banks cannot expand the money supply unless borrowers apply for loans. In this sense, it is the world's borrowers, students, home buyers, speculators, entrepreneurs, shopkeepers, and governments who determine the creation of money and whose borrowing expands or contracts the money supply. It is not, as orthodox economists argue, central banks that create the money supply. While they are responsible for the issue of the currency, for minting and printing, and for managing the value of the currency, and using the bank rate as a tool, central bankers do not print the money supply. No, commercial banks, working with their borrowers, print, in quotes, the bulk of the nation's money supply. As I've said, 95% in Britain and 98.9% in the US. This fact alone explains why monetarists in the 1980s, in trying to control the money supply, focused only, as was their wont, on the public sector, and ignored the massive expansion of credit generated by a newly deregulated private commercial bankers. Under their watch, inflation rocketed under Mrs. Thatcher, as too much money or credit chased too few goods or services. But to get back to the money supply itself, the creation of money is a bottom-up process. If borrowers are fearful, timid, and lack confidence, if times are hard or unstable, demand will be weak, as it is now. Entrepreneurs, etc., will not borrow from the banks. As a result, deposits will not be created, and the money supply will contract. As a consequence of a fall in the money supply, incomes, prices, and savings will fall, and the specter of deflation affects the economy. Alternatively, if borrowers, entrepreneurs, speculators are brimming with confidence, if they become recklessly euphoric about the possibility of speculative capital gains on, for example, the London property market, they expand the money supply by applying for more loans, and it is inflation then that is the threat. And as a result of the expansion of the money supply, incomes, prices, and savings will rise. It is not rocket science. So some in the sovereign money movement propose that we should abolish debt, strip bankers of their powers to create new public currency, in the words of Mary Meller, the sociologist, and return to a debt-free, gift-based economy. These activists seek to effectively nationalize the money supply, which would be expanded or contracted by a committee at the top of the world or the central bank, so that new public money could be issued by public monetary authorities free of debt to meet public needs. Interest rates would be left to the whim of the market. I worry at the authoritarian implications of transferring such economic power to unaccountable bureaucrats at the central bank. But for the purpose of this discussion, debt-free money is an oxymoron. There is no such thing as debt-free money, or if there is, it is very likely something quite different, a grant or a gift. Now, there is no real reason why society should not aspire to building a gift-based economy, one in which all the individuals in that economy rely on others for what Mary Miller calls provisioning, for clean air and a safe environment, for the gifts of food, health, housing, works of art, or for a smartphone. But to date, while we still enjoy the remnants of a gift-bearing culture, we have failed to develop an entirely gift-based economy. The closest we have come are economies in which we collectively gift joint resources to each other, for example, free education, a free health service, subsidized housing, and so on. But even in a socialist or social democratic society, socialized gifts, in quotes, are ultimately a claim on us all, claims settled via the taxation system. In a developed monetary system, all money is based on a system of claims, assets and liabilities backed up by collateral. It's always all a claim on another, an obligation to be reciprocated, or a debt. Andrea Terzi, the Italian economist, has it right. In a monetary economy, saving is different from the business of building up a surplus of corn and then lending it on. The corn can be saved without it ever affecting others. You consume it, you can waste it, you can eat it, it doesn't affect anybody else. Only if you decide to lend it will you establish a relationship with others. However, saving in an economy based on money always affects others because it is always an act that sets up a financial relationship with others, a claim. As Terzi says, in a monetary economy, saving is not a real quantity that anyone can independently own, like corn or gold or a collection of rare stamps. In a monetary economy, as opposed to a non-monetary economy, saving is an act that establishes a relationship with others in the form of a financial claim. Given this, it is the case that if savings in an economy are to expand, then it will be necessary for debt to expand too. That is what orthodox economists find so difficult to grasp as they battle to cut government debt in the vain hope of accumulating savings. That is the very reverse of what they should do. For savings to expand, then it will be necessary for debt, either private or public, to expand too. Savings need to be funded. And if the money supply has shrunk because the private sector has lost confidence, then the best way to fund savings would be for governments or private banks to issue new debt. Don't hold your breath. These are difficult concepts for our politicians to grasp. And so, dear friends, austerity is with us for a lot time longer. At a time of economic failure or slump, when unemployment rises, incomes and tax revenues fall, that is the time for the government to increase both private economic activity and savings in the economy by issuing debt. So debt is vital to the monetary system and to the health of the economy. And when it's created at high real rates of interest, it becomes unrepayable. And when credit or debt is used for speculation and not for sound income-generating activity, it is then that crises occur. These are the social relationships fundamental to a monetary economy. Relationships that generate the credit and then the income and finally the savings needed for investment, employment, and all manner of useful and important activities. Orthodox economists have it the other way round. They think of money as being the thing that happens when a farmer has sowed his seed and waited for his harvest for the rain to fall and the sun to shine, and for there to be a harvest, and then he takes his harvest to market, and he sells it, and he ends up with a surplus, and then we have money. In fact, the system works in very much the reverse way. They look at the monetary system through the wrong end of their theoretical telescopes. So, and this is what you'd all been hoping to hear, I think, how to subordinate bankers to the role of servants, not masters. Today, the international monetary system is run by the equivalent of Goethe's sorcerer's apprentice. In the absence of the equivalent of the sorcerer, regulatory democracy, financial risk takers and fraudsters have, since 1971, periodically crashed the global economy and trashed the lives of millions of people. And let's be clear. There is no such thing as effective global regulation. Ask the Bitcoiners. That is why they operate in the dark web. Policy and regulation requires boundaries. Pensions policy, criminal justice policy, taxation policy, policies for the protection of intellectual property all require boundaries. Finance capital abhors boundaries. Like the Sausage Apprentice, global financiers want to be free to use the magic of money creation to flood the global economy with easy, if dear, money, and just as frequently to starve economies of any affordable finance. And they want to have the freedom to do that in the absence of the sorcerer, the high priest, the chieftain, the respected elder of the village, regulatory democracy. If we want to subordinate bankers to the role of servants of the economy, then capital control over both inflows and outflows is and will always be a vital tool for doing so. If we really want to take back control, we will have to bring offshore capital back onshore. That is the only way to restore order to the domestic economy, but also to the global economy. Second, it goes without saying that in a domestic economy, given that the private banking system is backed by publicly financed institutions, monetary relationships must be carefully managed by the equivalent of local trusted chieftains. Loans, credit must be deployed for productive employment, income-generating activity for the repayment of debts and taxes. Money lent must not be burdened by high, unpayable real rates of interest. Rates of interest for loans across the spectrum of lending, short and long term, safe and risky, and in real terms, must be managed by public authority, not private authority, is my view, if loans are to be sustainable and repayable and if debt is not going to lead to systemic failure. John Maynard Keynes explained how this could be done with his liquidity preference theory. Profoundly important for policymakers and largely ignored by the profession because it involves public rather than private authority over money. Third, money, loans, credit for rent-seeking and speculation, gambling or betting must be made inadmissible because it leads to capital gains that can rise exponentially, but speculation can also lead to catastrophic losses. The good news is that if well managed, these claims, the promises, the social relationships are potentially infinite. By contrast, human wit, intelligence, and muscle are finite. Commodities like gold, soybeans, and even oil are finite. Resources like clean water and safe atmosphere are finite. So these are the real limits we face. Our capacity for social relationships and for using money to facilitate these relationships do not face the same limitation. The question is, who controls our social relationships? Private, unaccountable, rent-seeking authority or public, democratic, regulatory authority? To take back control from the bankers requires, I assert, control by public authority, our regulatory democracy operating within national boundaries. A sound monetary system can provide all the finance that society needs. If well managed, there need never be a shortage of money for society's most urgent projects. Within a sound monetary system, there is never no money. The very real possibility of using public awareness and political will to restore such a system is why I see a horizon of hope that could help us move away from apocalypse and towards utopia. Thank you very much.
So, a couple of things to keep in mind about the Q&A. So, try to keep it concise and limit yourself to one question so lots of people can have a chance. And then wait until one of the stewards will hand you the microphone. So, one, and then we'll take a couple questions in a row. So one at the end.
Hi, Anne. Thanks very much for the talk.
Where are you?
Over here.
Oh, there
sorry.
You are. Hi. And your name?
Ken Rumpf. Works for an investment bank. Can I ask, how would you separate sort of gambling and speculation from legitimate but risky lending? I start a business and, you know, it may or may not succeed and so on.
Right. We're going to have a few questions.
And then there's one over there.
John Strafford. You say how to control money is, for example, you bring offshore funds onto onshore. Who does it and how?
And your name is?
John Strafford.
John, thank you.
And there was one question on the balcony on the at the back. Yes.
Hi, my name... Can you hear it? Can you hear it?
Yes, okay. Hi.
Okay, my name is Susan Casey. You mentioned at the end there are national boundaries. I mean, isn't part of our problem that we are in an enormous phase of technological development that slips so easily over national boundaries? I don't know quite how we're going to resurrect those.
And your name was?
Susan Casey.
Sorry, thanks, Susan.
Okay,
that it? Right. Those are all very, very big and difficult questions. How to separate speculative from risky activity? Simply by risk assessment. Just simply by the central bank offering guidance to banks. You know, the banks are effectively, right now, they're all nationalized banks. The banks could not survive now without QE, without all the liquidity generated by central banks, and they couldn't survive without very low interest rates. Again, rates, bank rates, that are issued by the central bank. So without all of this largesse, they would be bust. So we can put terms and conditions on them. And governments and central banks can offer guidance, as they've done in the past. So I think it's a matter of, you know, making decisions about this. And we've seen this happen in the past. Macroprudential tools are what should be used. But in particular, banks should not be treated as if they were just free-floating institutions in the economy. They are not. The reason why they were bailed out, the reason why they have massive public resources, is because they are systemic to the economy. They are fundamental to it. And I just think we should apply terms and conditions to the way in which they operate and assess risk. Now, of course, it gets more difficult in the shadow banking sector, and I'm no expert on how to manage that. But I'm merely arguing for economic principles, and I know that there is enough brains and intelligence out there for that to be translated into regulations and to terms that will be applied. And can I just say that one of the things that we need to remember is that banks rely heavily on the judicial system for the enforcement of contracts. We could just simply argue that our judicial system would render contracts void if they were not well managed and if they were not productive in their outcomes. So we can do this. An awful lot of power that we have that we pretend we don't have over the banking system. So how do you bring money onshore? Well, again, that's a matter for the authorities. I'm no expert in that, but we know that it can be done. And again, it can be done in terms of, well, if you want to do business, you've got to be located here, and you've got to show that you've invested here. And I'm sorry if you think that's ridiculous, but but I can assure you that if we don't do it in a managed way, John, it's going to happen in a very badly unmanaged one, because we're now in an era of protectionism and nationalism. And we know China, for example, operates capital controls effectively. The price of Bitcoin today collapsed because so many people are trying to dodge capital controls in China by buying bitcoins. And the People's Bank of China today decided to investigate that, and the price of bitcoins collapsed. So we know that central banks can act and can enforce capital controls. And the question is, how are they going to do it? Are they going to do it in a way which is reactionary, or are they going to do it in a stable, managed way? Is the finance sector going to find suddenly that the walls go up, or is it going to be done in a sound, managed way and a sensible way? That's really what's going to be the difference, because you are going to get that. You're going to get massive protectionism now with the rise of populism, because people cannot stand the level of volatility and instability that the financial sector imposes on society. So what about technological development? Well, I'm not afraid of technological development, because I think, yes, of course, there's digital money, but we have controls over that if we choose to use them. Ask the Chinese, you know, ask the Russians. I think that it is entirely possible. What is really missing is the political will to use technological developments to subordinate the finance sector to the interests of society.
All right, next round. There was a question in the middle on the balcony. You already have a microphone. That's great.
And then, hello. My name is Max Bigot.
Wait a second. Okay, go ahead.
Martin?
Max. Marine Le Pen in France is advocating transferring the power to issue money from private banks to central banks.
Yeah.
Are you supportive of this measure?
Right, thank you.
And then there's two more on the balcony, right? Close to each other. There.
Yeah?
Michael Edwards, Just Space. You said a bit about speculative rent-seeking behaviour in the real estate markets. Next week, the city councillors of Haringey in London are threatening to decide to hand over something like £2 billion worth of public land and council estates and shopping centres and stuff to the Lend-Lease Corporation, a much bigger operation than Southwark did at the Elephant and Castle and Haygate. Have you got any suggestions as to what we should say a municipality should be doing in these conditions in contemporary London? How can they hold on to the value of their assets?
Could you give us your thoughts on the new Chicago plan with Michael Komfov?
Let's add one more here, right in front of the balcony.
And your name is?
Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
Is there another microphone? Right.
It seems like most of this behaviour, the risk-taking, the recklessness, and just the general, the level of power that they have in the banking sector is so vast that even if we were able to legislate some of the control back into the public sector, would this not have to be done on a global scale, given that it is so easy, coming back to, there was a question earlier about going offshore, given that it's so easy now to just move operations or headquarters even to avoid having to pay the tax in the jurisdiction that you're earning your profits in. How can it ever be enough just to do it in one country or even in one continent? And is it even possible to do it on a global scale?
And your name is?
Penny.
Penny, thanks. Right, so those are big questions as well now. I'm Le Pen. No, I'm absolutely opposed. I think that's, and it's a proposal that is advanced here in Britain as well by NGOs in Britain, that the central bank should print all the money and it should be, and private banks should be stripped of that. I think it's a reactionary proposal. I think private banks should retain power to create money in collaboration with borrowers. That's the point I was trying to make, is that in a sense it's a bottom-up democratic process, the creation of credit. But the bank should be regulated, properly regulated. To simply give the powers to unaccountable bureaucrats in a central bank seems to me to be the sort of thing Marine Le Pen would argue for, which is why I'm so dismayed that NGOs in this country are arguing for it. Then what do I think Andrew asks about the new Chicago plan? There's a long section in the book, by the way, on the old Chicago plan. I don't think much of it at all. I think it is monetarism, once again. But monetarism with a difference. This time, it recognizes that banks create money. And then, Susan, on this question of whether it should be global, of course it ought to perhaps best of all be global, international. And it's very hard to think how on earth, governments are going to collaborate across the world, because there's a determination, and there has been a determination, led, by the way, by the British government, not to have international coordination between countries, between the G8 or the G20 or whatever. There's been this notion that we should all just get on with things, and anyway, the financial markets can manage without our intervention. So that kind of coordination, especially with Donald Trump in the White House, seems very unlikely. But having said that, we must never underestimate the power that we have at home. No bank can operate without being licensed by a central bank. No bank can operate. And our central bank is a nationalised bank. We nationalised the Bank of England in 1946 because of the debacle of the 1930s, for which it was also largely responsible. It's effectively another government department. And so, you know, if a private bank wants to operate here, if it wants to take advantage of the immense liquidity that the Bank of England and other central banks are offering, if it wants to take advantage of the very low rates of interest that the Bank of England offers this, and this is the thing, the banks are taking this cheap money and lending dear, right? And they're taking cheap and lending dear to whole countries. They're making massive amount of money out of this, and we're sitting back and let it happen. We should say, you may have access to cheap funding from the Bank of England, you may have access to quantitative easing or whatever, but these are the terms and conditions. And we should lay those down and not simply allow them to ride roughshod across our banks. And it's this sense that we are powerless against these institutions which gives them their great power. And I do think we have to challenge that. That's it. Yeah. Oh, on Michael, your question is just too big, really. And I think I'm very clever, but I don't have the answer to all these questions. And your problem is a very big problem. I would say only this, and that is that local authority is in a great deal of difficulty. You know, you can earn a lot more money by turning your council housing into private housing and renting it out, and you can then earn the rents to compensate for the fact that central government has cut your budget so massively. They're in a really very difficult position. So I'm very critical of them, but I also fully understand the responsibility is with the central government on the one hand, and it's with the ideology that actually governments don't need to do this. We can leave it to the private sector, and the private sector has nothing to do. It has no more ambition than to be able to be rent-seeking and to use those properties in order to extract more rent. So I have no advice on how you should mobilise against that, but I urge you to do so.
Okay. There's a question here in the front. Actually, there's two here in the front.
Oh, someone... Did I answer on the Chicago plan?
Yeah,
yes,
did.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Phil Walden.
Hello, Phil.
I see the question that you've addressed tonight as linked to the question of how do we create a more egalitarian society. But at the last general election, the Labour Party failed to make any argument that the share of government spending should go up. So does this mean that we either accept a much more inegalitarian society or that we create a better political party than the Labour Party?
Just pass the microphone to the person in that. I think it was... you had a question, too? I'll just go.
Hi. Very much enjoyed the talk. I enjoyed the talk. Steve McCusker. Early on, you mentioned about predicting the crash, 2006. I think you wrote a book on that. I'd be interested to know if you think that now we're heading towards a secondary depression or downwave.
Yeah.
I think there was a question in the back. Yeah, and then that one on the balcony.
Thank you, Peter Falarson. I have I sense a bit of a tension in your argument between your suspicion of private banks, more than suspicion really, and also your suspicion of public authorities kind of being in charge of allocating credit or making monetary decisions. And I just wonder, who do you actually think is qualified to make risk-based credit allocation decisions if it's not one of those two entities?
And then the final for this round, so the balcony, go ahead.
Hello, that's Martin Walker.
I didn't get your name.
Peter.
Peter. Yeah.
Oh, hello, that's Martin. You talked about the example of China in relation to capital controls, but don't you think the experience of China in the last 18 months or so has shown the actual problems of having an economy that's connected with the rest of the world but attempts to have capital controls? China, even with capital controls, has lost a quarter of its foreign exchange reserves in an 18-month period. Mm. It's about $1 trillion. How do you propose to deal with that in your model when we've actually seen the problems of actually trying to actually achieve that?
Yeah, Chai.
So, Peter, the tension between public and private authority. By public authority, I mean regulatory democracy. I mean an authority that's overseen by democratic institutions. My worry about giving power to bureaucrats in the central bank is that they're invisible and unaccountable, and they have a job and a place and a role to play. But they are not the ones that are accountable for really the big decisions in that ought to be accountable for the big decisions. I mean, to give the power to a committee of men at the central bank to decide the money supply is a very authoritarian idea, in my view. Okay. No, I don't think politicians should have that either. This is why I think a banking system is a good thing. And I know it might sound a little contradictory. But the point is, a well-managed, regulated banking system can do this. You know, you could nationalise the banks, and then you could have government clerks making risk assessments about whether Mrs. Jones should get a loan, or the shopkeeper should get half, or the speculator should get $1 million. But I don't think that's what bureaucrats, you know, I don't think that's what civil servants should be doing. I think the private sector could do that just as they did that between 1945 and 1971. When I first took out a mortgage, I was scrutinised very carefully by the bank manager. Nowadays, you know, you can get a loan more or less from the end of from a voice at the end of a telephone. So it's not a matter of saying. I know it doesn't sound straightforward, but I think a private banking system can do the job, but it has to be managed and it has to be regulated. Martin, on China, China's had capital controls actually for a much longer time than the last 18 months. Yeah, no, I understand that. And those capital controls have not been effective. And China is kind of split on this issue. You know, China wants to be a capitalist economy, but on the other hand, the Communist Party feels it has to manage the economy and in order to not have any upheavals or social revolts, because they can be extremely damaging in China. So they are split. They're split between the desire to be an open capitalist economy and to be this economy that manages restiveness and unrest inside their societies. But the fact is that if China wanted to manage her flows, she could. But the problem is also that the global economy is now so unbalanced, with the enormous deficit that the United States has and the enormous surplus that China and Japan have, that actually, you know, China is as caught in that in those imbalances as everybody else. But how China solves her problem, really, I don't know. And I'm not in a position to advise the Chinese Communist Party.
Tomorrow is going to what you're proposing might happen. So if you have economies which adopt your model and presumably continue trading with the rest of the world, you have the same kind of pressures to actually cause money to flow out of those economies.
No, on the contrary. You know, I think what I'm trying to say to you is that we have had such a model. We know that it works. It worked between 1945 and 1971. And it was constructed, it was built very particularly so as not to repeat the crises of the 20s and 30s, right? We had volatile, mobile capital in the 20s and 30s. We had disasters, we had crises, we had a world war. And, you know, in 1944, a bunch of economists without a single banker in the room devised a new architecture, and that lasted for 30 years until the bankers lobbied for it to be dismantled, right? So we know how to do it, and we know that it takes, as Susan says, international coordination. There are ways to do it. We are not helpless, passive human beings that just have to lie down and be destroyed by economic forces that we believe to be beyond our control. Of course, it's going to take a lot of brains to do that, but if we don't even start thinking that it's possible, if we take a highly defeatist approach to it, then we might as well just give up and allow, first of all, the rise of right-wing parties and fascism and war, or alternatively, we could say no. We know that there's an alternative to this. We know that if you use sound common sense and good economics instead of flawed economics, you can actually solve this problem. We know because we've got experience of it, right? So it's a question of whether we want to be defeatist about it and say it's impossible, or whether we want to drive the political will that would make it happen and stabilize the global economy and, you know, restore public and political stability. You know, what do you want to do? What do you want to have? Which world do you want to live in? I don't want to live in the world that is now rolled out for us by Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen.
Shall we do one more round of questions?
No, I'm exhausted.
You're exhausted.
It's been much too long.